We are having public testimony today, and I think that it's incumbent upon us to not go any time beyond 10 after 1 in order that we might hear all the people who've come today to testify on the redesigning temporary assistance to needy families. And so I opened the public hearing on House Bill 2469, and we open as a subcommittee of a subcommittee until we have a quorum of members that are here. Thank you very much. Ms. Baker?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. As the chair indicated, House Bill 2469 deals with the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. As you may recall, during the budget discussions, we talked about how the budget anticipates a restructuring of this program to meet changes at the federal level in how the program operates. So you have a copy of the A. Gross bill before you. This was as it came out of the House Substantive Committee. There is also a staff measure summary from that committee to summarize what is in the bill. And then today, Representative Kotek will be doing a presentation as invited testimony. Then we'll get comments from the Department of Human Services and then go into the sign-up witness sheet.
Thank you. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, and I'm very pleased to be here today. Thank you, Chair Carter, for hearing this bill. And we have a PowerPoint presentation, and hoping to get through most of it before taking questions, but feel free to jump in. Trying to provide a high-level overview for everyone. But before I start, I just want to say that this is a very collaborative product that's come out of a good 8 to 9 months of work. Last fall, the department convened a stakeholder group when federal regulation changes precipitated the need to sit down and go, what are we going to do with our program? At the time, I was part of that group as policy director at Children First for Oregon, so I've been with it the entire time. And the department submitted a bill because they had to get one started. That was House Bill 2180. 2469 was one that I introduced, and what we have before you today is 2469A, which is it's a consensus bill, takes into account the agency bill and the bill I introduced, and it's been a very collaborative process for a lot of stakeholders involved. I want to thank the Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee, who did several public hearings, several workshops on the bill. You will be seeing the Dash 20 amendments during our next work session. Those are what I'm calling our last bit of housekeeping. This is a very technical bill that things kept popping up, so we'll have another set of language changes that hopefully are just, you know, we just need to get them in there and just make sure they're all correct. So you'll be seeing those in the next work session. So, as you know, we heard from the department earlier in the session that we're redesigning our Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program for the purpose of improving our self-sufficiency programs, improving what we do to help very low-income children and their families. We have a real opportunity in front of us, as you know. Sometimes when the federal government changes things, we all kind of go, oh, my God, here we go. But this is a real opportunity being pushed upon us by changes at the federal level. So the reason we're doing it now, as you know, there are new federal requirements under the Deficit Reduction Act, which I'll talk a little bit about. Also, many of you know we had operated under a waiver for many years that allowed us a lot more flexibility. That waiver went away, and then we had the new changes under the Deficit Reduction Act. What's at stake? We could be subject to very high federal penalties, up to $14 million annually, if we don't meet new work participation requirements under the federal government. So it's an opportunity to keep out of penalty, but also to reinvest in our program. The future of our children is also at stake. We have a very low-income population that we help through the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, and by improving the program, we'll improve their future outcomes as well. What we've been trying to do through this entire process is to focus on our children. Do you realize this is a kids' program? And by helping the parents, we are helping the children. And we should keep that in mind as we look through the structural changes. We need to improve the success of our low-income families so they not only get on the path to self-sufficiency, but stay on the path so they don't come back into the program. Because that's not good for their kids, not good for what we're trying to do in terms of what we spend on our programs. And so what we're trying to do here with the next bullet is create a program or improvement program that looks at what other states have done, what the research says are good strategies to do. So you'll see some new things in the program with the goal of improving our outcomes. End game, we need to meet the new federal requirements so we aren't penalized. And ultimately, we're renewing our investment and our commitment to this population. As you remember, we had that discussion about not being able to meet maintenance of effort. And that's because we have stepped back from our commitment to this population of children and families. Here's an opportunity to renew the commitment, to renew the investment. And I will also say that what we do in this program impacts other systems, as you know. How it impacts children going into the child welfare system, the correction system, if we're not successful with certain families. So there's a lot at stake here, and that's why this is a very important bill. This chart is from the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I just want to remind folks that we have stepped back from our investment. We've had trouble meeting our MOE. This chart shows that in 91-93, we were spending approximately $700 million on self-sufficiency programs. In 05-07 dollars, we're now at $349 million. So the time is now to look at our program. We haven't significantly changed the program in over a decade, and so that's what this bill attempts to do. So quick review of the current TANF program. As you know, we provide cash assistance to very low-income families. The jobs program is the employment preparation and training component. Families under the new federal regs are limited to 60 months of federally funded TANF assistance over their lifetime. And near the end of the coming biennium, we will have some individuals reaching that 60-month timeline. So there's a lot of discussion in the bill around exemptions and extensions around those time limits, and we'll get into those as well. Currently, TANF serves about 18,000 Oregon families, about 40,000 individuals, two-thirds of whom are children. You need to have children in the household to be eligible for TANF. To qualify for TANF here in Oregon, families must earn less than 43% of the federal poverty level, which is approximately $616 per month for a family of three. To put that in perspective, $616 is approximately 18.2 hours a week at minimum, or 18.2 hours a week at minimum wage. So if a single parent with two kids is working 19 hours a week at minimum wage, they make too much to qualify for our TANF program. This is a really important part of the puzzle. Because if you start working to any great degree, you're no longer eligible for TANF. And one of the things we're facing with the new federal requirements is we have to have more people in our program working, according to new federal definitions. So the way our program is structured, as over time, the accountable income limit has decreased as a percentage of poverty. So early in the early 90s, you could be making somewhat closer to the federal poverty line, still be in the program. Now it's less than 45%. We're at 43% of the federal poverty line. So we have a very high need population in this program who, for a variety of reasons, is unable to work more than a very minimum amount of work. This is another chart showing the same things. This is the number of weekly hours a minimum wage worker could work and still remain eligible. So as you see, we're not helping people in the way that if we're telling them to go out and get a job, and then we pull the supports out from under them once they start working a little bit. That's just the structure of our program. The grant level for our program is also relatively low compared to other states. So if you're only making about $600 a month for a family of three to get on the program, then your grant is only 33% of the federal poverty level, so for about $470. So this isn't exactly a cushy program that people are wanting to get in and stay on. So I think we always need to keep that in mind. This is another chart showing you that the purchasing power of the TANF grant has reduced over time, and we haven't adjusted that. I think this is important context to understand.
Just a moment, please.
Representative, and I apologize for this is the first time I've seen this, but I'm kind of confused. There's three different numbers now. In the background on the staff major summary, it says the current maximum monthly benefit for a family of three is 503, and then there's, is that last one, was that a family of three?
Chair Carter, Representative, thank you for that. I believe that probably has the, there is an incentive amount on top. There's a little add-on. I'm assuming that's what the difference between the 461 and the
Yeah, 600.
The cooperation incentive. That's what we call it.
What?
The cooperation incentive?
Oh, what's that?
Sorry. I confess not to be the expert in TANF, but I probably know more than I should, but.
Members of the committee, Chair Carter.
Just I don't think I'm on there.
Okay. Just before you begin, what I want to do is to kind of set some kind of parameters because we have a couple of other bills. And can we ask the committee, if you don't mind, unless it's a pressing question,
okay.
You can you can answer
it's
the question.
Well,
No. Hold on. just a management piece here that we can hold our questions and until the end. And then let's go take a back and ask you and the department to just tell us what House Bill 2469A does. That would be very, very helpful to me.
Absolutely, Chair Carter, and I'm getting right there right now.
Thank you.
Just wanted to give, I mean, it's been a while since we heard the presentation from the department.
So
just to remind folks.
Just want to answer Representative Boone's question. I think, Todd, you're about to do it, Mr. Todd.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, Vic Todd, Administrator for the Self-Sufficiency Programs at DHS. The cooperation incentive is a piece that's added to the benefit for clients who are cooperating with the jobs program. And that was added, I want to say, 7-8 years ago in response to a food stamp federal change.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Carter, Representative Boone. And I would just, if I could briefly just talk about this slide on the Deficit Reduction Act. What's important about it is the second bullet, which says, under the Deficit Reduction Act, 50% of our adult TANF recipients have to be employed or engaged in work activities as defined by federal law. Because we had a waiver before the new regulations, we had a lot more flexibility. The federal laws are telling us that people have to work a certain number of hours. They define much closer what is work. And even though some of the activities we've been doing that we've considered work, for example, alcohol and drug treatment type things, some of those are allowable, but only for a certain amount of time. So there's a whole other complex set of definitions that really, if you look at the bottom bullet, only 15% of our mandatory adult caseload, 15% is currently meeting the new work requirements. Mm-hmm. So we have to get to that 50%. This is what's driving what we need to do here at the program. So 2469A does a variety of things. First off, and probably what I would consider the most important, it strengthens the screening and assessment that we're going to do for folks coming in the door. If you're eligible for TANF, as we've noted, the income eligibility is rather low, you probably have some barriers, probably have some things going on. We want to make sure that you're assessed properly when you come in the door to make sure we put you in the right track of support to move you out of the program eventually into self-sufficiency. We're creating a state family pre-SSI-SSDI program, which will help TANF families who would probably be better served by being on supplemental security or supplemental security disability income to apply for that program and still get benefits at the same time. Once they're on the federal program, then the state will be reimbursed for the benefits they would receive from the federal government. It's an 18-24-month process to get on SSI or SSDI. So we're creating a state program that provides a track for folks who, because of a disability, would be better served in that regard. We're creating a post-TANF program that talks about once you start making a little too much money because you're working, in most cases, more than 20 hours a week at minimum wage, we're going to put you into a 12-month program that will provide a monthly stipend to give you a little bit of extra resource, plus wraparound services such as medical assistance, child care, and other things to keep you working, and then to help you stay out of the program as a participant. So the post-TANF program will help us meet our work participation rates because we will then be able to count that population of individuals who we're helping while they're working. That little bit of help will allow us to count them towards our work participation rate. It's a very critical part of what we're trying to achieve. We're also going to be expanding access to post-secondary educational opportunities. Many of you recall the Parents of Scholars Bill from the 2003 session. We're putting that back in, and we'll talk about that a little bit. Another important change in the program, because of some new flexibility at the federal level. We're going to be recommending this bill to allow families to keep a portion of their child support. Currently, right now, that doesn't happen. I'll talk a little bit more about that. We're also going to be preventing clients from being inappropriately sanctioned, so we're actually addressing their barriers instead of just removing their grant through this, the changes in this bill. And we're going to ensure that, a very important point, hopefully, is that folks who are working and are in the post-TANF program will continue to have medical assistance. Very critical if they're going to, you know, have stability and stay working. So I'll go through this fairly quickly because it's in your handout. What we're calling the pre-TANF program is the strengthened screening and assessment. We really lack statewide uniformity in how we screen and assess clients. Under 24-69.
Hold on just a minute. Mm-hmm. Todd, come on. So in terms of that first system, what plans are in the hopper to be able to deal with a statewide assessment procedure, a uniform statewide screening and testing procedure?
Chair Carter, members of the committee, at this point what we have are seven different work groups that are currently working on all of these different elements in terms of laying out how those processes would be delivered. And we're using that as a methodology to ensure that there's a consistent approach across the state. And while there will be some variability in different locations just because of the availability of services, the overall intent is to have the same sets of services available.
Just a quick question, and he can, Mr. Todd can give the answer later if he doesn't know it and send it to me. But, you know, when I'm sitting here, I wonder how this differs from what we used to do before we had some policy changes and before we had budget reductions, because this sounds similar to our jobs program that we were so successful with a lot of years ago. And so we did do screening and the assessment and had wraparound services. So I would be interested in, at some point, Mr. Todd, you can send it to my office, give it to the rest of this committee. You don't have to do it now, how we really differ than from the old jobs program.
Thank you, Chair Carter. I think the one key piece around screening and assessment is the second bullet there under what 2469A would do. It's about more client participation in their individualized case plan by doing proper, more uniform screening and assessment, not only at the beginning but throughout the process along the stages of their participation in the program, and tying that back to their individual case plan in a way that actually helps the participants succeed. That's what we're shooting for here. And so the department is looking at internal procedures, how they can do that differently, and that's a really key point of what we're trying to achieve with this program redesign. I already mentioned the post-TANF program. What I would say about that is this is absolutely essential if we're going to meet the work participation rate requirements that the federal government is asking all states to do. Once someone is working, as I've mentioned before, and ineligible for the program, they'll receive a $150 cash grant up to 12 months, up to until they or until they're earning 250% of the poverty line, and they'll receive other supports. The goal here is to help those folks stay working and be able to count them as working in our work participation rates. And because we're using maintenance of effort dollars to do that, that gets at our goal of doing more around our MOE requirement, but we can count those individuals in the work participation rate. Another plus of that is using MOE funds does not carry time limit restrictions, so that 60-month time limit would not count for the post-TANF, which is appropriate because we're asking people to go out and work. They'll be working. They'll be in the post-TANF program. If, for some reason, they end up having to go into the full TANF program again, then the clock would start again, and that is an appropriate way to incentivize people to go out and work. As I mentioned before, we're going to have a couple tracks that will be paid for with non-MOE state-funded dollars. The reason we're doing this is one of the ways you get at your work participation rate requirement is to remove a certain set of populations from your denominator. If your pool of people that you're counting for work is a little smaller, it's easier for us to get our work participation rate up. So what we're doing here with the SSIS-SDI program and the two-family program is saying these are populations of individuals who need more flexibility in how we serve them. And so by using non-MLE state-funded, making state-funded only programs, we have more flexibility for the two parents in particular. The Deficit Reduction Act says 90% of them should be working 40 hours a week. It's a really high bar. We have very vulnerable families. Let's set that those sets of families aside in terms of how we pay for their benefits, give them more flexibility, and that will help serve those families better and help us meet our work participation rates because they're not part of the total calculation. Same thing with the individuals with disabilities who would be applying for SSI-SSDI.
So, Mr. Todd, are these people already in the system?
Chair Carter, members of the committee, yes.
Okay. And so you just kick it up a notch and better manage the processes in terms of the kind of jobs that they have, the kind of schooling that they get.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, this group will have the same requirements with respect to expectations around participation as the one-parent families. The difference here is that what you use for a funding source. Outside of that, they have the same requirements.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Guerrero?
Representative, could I ask you to go back to a previous slide?
Absolutely.
The one just before that, if you would. Yeah. If you look under the current program, it seems to me that one of the main problems facing this program is the fact that a lot of these folks can't hold jobs. They keep coming back in. They lose, come back in, lose, come back in. I'm concerned that I don't see anything, and perhaps you can elaborate, on a program that educates these people that are in the program to hold a job. I don't see that emphasis anywhere. I see the emphasis simply on making the program easier for them.
Chair Carter, Representative Gord, thank you for the question. I think what we're seeing in our current program is we have people with, the folks who are cycling back in, there are things going on in their lives, maybe some barriers, maybe they need treatment programs, maybe they need a little bit more education and training. I don't think our current program is really set up to assess those very well, and it's a little bit more of a, let's put you into the jobs program, let's treat you the way we treat everybody in the general population, and, you know, and sink or swim, off you go into the program. I think there's just more of a likelihood for them to come back in the program. What we're trying to do with the redesign is better screening assessment, meet their barrier removal needs, as we call them, make sure that they're a little more stable, so when they do go off the program, and we keep them a little tied into the program through the post-TANF when they go off working, so it's not this cliff, it's more of a transition into employment. We're hoping that combination of things will help those families stay out of the program and move a little bit quicker and more stabilized into self-sufficiency. So I think it's a combination of things. I don't think we've properly identified and met the individual needs of certain clients. You have the folks who might be better served because they have a disability going into the SSI-SSDI track instead of assuming that they're going to function at the same level as other folks in the employment sector. So I think it's a combination of things. I don't know if Mr. Todd wants to comment on that.
Chair Carter, members of the committee. No, I mean, I think that is it. I think that this client population, in a lot of cases, has very little employment experience, and that's one of the challenges in getting them into the workforce.
So I think my first question is a little different. What do you do in terms of your life skills training that would help them to be more committed to following through on whatever program they enter, and you can be able to monitor that change within a reasonable length of time as opposed to people going out, coming in, going out. And I think he's talking about the revolving door concept, which we do see a lot in human services. And so what is in this new DRA that is going to sustain this kind of person in the program better?
Thank you, Madam Chair. much more eloquent than that.
And Chair Carter, while we have someone else from the department answer that question, the other thing I would say is that we have to remember there are some people who will come in the door to apply for TANF who are going through a family crisis, and they will not be on the program very long. They are very likely to jump into employment with a little bit of resources. So we have a variety of folks in the population, and I think we should just keep that in mind. Applicants aren't all the same, and what's key is that the individualized plans, hopefully with the redesign, will really meet the individual needs of the families, and by doing that, you're going to see success. And I don't think we've done that very well, and I think that's a mission everyone would probably agree with.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Light. I'm the TANF manager with Department of Human Services. One of the things that we're doing within this new package is we do include additional resources to expand our jobs program, and one of the pieces of that is to purchase some additional life skills courses, some additional education, expand some of our barrier removal professionals that we can pay for. And another part of this is better coordination with our other workforce partners.
Okay.
And I think that workforce partner connection through the continuum of the workforce is really critical to maintaining people's momentum as they kind of work through the career continuum.
Because this is a long-term question that the legislature has been asking, I know in my 22 years of being here, is that what UDHS is doing in terms of helping people to have some level of accountability to sustaining their own needs to go forward and be successful. And that's a very good question that the representative is asking. So what is in your program that's going to help do that? And so you said your partners will help you do that, lifelong learning skills classes in the community college, and are you monitoring partners for success?
Chair Carter, members of the committee, as part of the entire system, the entire workforce system does have outcomes that are within its I hate to use the acronym, but I can't off the top of my head. I can't remember exactly what it is, but it's called PRISM. It's a system that the Employment Department utilizes, and they track all those outcomes across the system.
That's good. Senator Wizard, just a quick question to ask if you're going to include it in this package, because Oregon was very successful and led the nation in job placements and both initial and retention, by the way. It was with having jobs and jobs plus, as well as having adequate dollars for daycare, because it was very critical that you had to be able to provide daycare services to the working parent. And I don't know, this proposal doesn't address that. It doesn't address particularly jobs plus, which brings in the employer into the equation. And is there some reason why this is not in this proposal?
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, excellent question. I think the department could better address the jobs plus issue. On the child care issue, what I would say about that is what we're going to do with employment-related daycare is absolutely interconnected to what we do with this program, because we are going to be asking families that we are going to be helping to support in the post-TANF program to get to work. So the child care part is really important.
I want to add to that, because we had child care. The problem occurred was the cutoff level.
Absolutely.
Where individuals, once they increase their earnings to $2 or $10, we then no longer provided the daycare subsidy. And so I guess, you know, if we're going to go down this path again, I would like to see a scale that says, or the impact, because that did more than anything to, in my estimation, from reducing us down to where we no longer became the leader in the country of actually taking TANF clients and made them employable.
Chair Carson,
we're at 15%.
And one thing I would point out is hopefully we're going to continue with the governor's recommendation to increase the income eligibility for employment-related daycare at 185% of poverty. So that's one thing. Now, as you notice, what we're planning in post-TANF is we could be surveying people in post-TANF up to 250% of poverty. Could have a little gap there in child care assistance. I can talk more about that. The other thing I want to mention before I forget is research is showing us that the programs that supplement earnings, which is what we're doing in post-TANF, we're supplementing someone who's out there working, we're making sure they have a little extra money, a little more support. Those programs have shown good outcomes in terms of people cycling back into the program. So just that post-TANF program alone and that extra bit of transitional support for another year is going to hopefully, according to the research, reduce that cycling back into the program.
Madam Chair, I would like a response from the agency about jobs and job stress, because without those components, the way you actually have the jobs resource and have the employees on board, I think we're back to where square one.
Chair Carter, Senator Winters, part of the package, the redesign package, is an expansion of the TANF Jobs Plus program. It in effect is tripling about what our current level is. We're a little over 100 slots per month right now. We'll be going to something closer to 300.
Jobs Plus. And what are we doing in jobs?
Well, in jobs, we're also expanding services. I talked a little bit about some additional resources within the package to beef up our assessment processes, some resources for additional life skills and some vocational education, as well as some additional expansion of the jobs program itself, like for the regular activities like work experience.
Follow up. If I do the math, to get us to 50%, I think we're currently, there's about 18,000 of Oregon families each month in TANF, and we currently have 15% that we now are okay to qualify, which leaves us another 35%. Is that correct?
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, that's correct. The 18,000 families are not, some of those are non-needy caretakers, which means they're child-only grants.
Okay.
So we'd have to pull up that number for you. But
so if we could pull out that number so that we could get the actual universe, because if you're looking at 100 slots, how many slots technically would we need, you know, on the Jobs Plus side? You know, could that be 200? Or 300, because I think it's important that we have that information back from the agency.
And Chair Carter and Senator Winters, I think that's, I know the department, at least back in the fall I saw, they had a nice chart showing if we do this, we get this many more folks participating, and we can get you that information. We won't get into all the budget details today, but, and I think what I forgot to mention was, what you're going to see at the end, the price tag for $24.69 is on top of what we're already currently spending. So we're building on the existing program, and that means tweaking the existing program as well as having some enhancements that will, you know, get us over the line and get us to what we need to do. So
let me just say to the department, when you differ from Ms. Kotek, you might want to speak up, because you're going to be on record and the legislature is going to be expecting things to be carried through. So if you don't speak up, that means that we're running in the direction of the way Ms. Kotek is speaking. So when you differ, you need to speak up as a department.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, I could do my testimony right now then. We are in alignment with this, where this bill is going.
Okay, I'm saying any questions that she answers, make sure that it differs from anything at all.
Thank you, Chair Carter, because these are the program experts, so I expect them to nudge me if I get it wrong.
Exactly.
So, absolutely.
And so that the record won't show, the record will show where you differ or you're doing something different than the answer to it, so that we can be clear and so you won't be held accountable for something that you're really not doing or that you are doing. That's all I'm saying.
Thank you.
Speak up. Excuse me, Ms. Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. I just wanted to follow up a little bit on Senator Winter's question about child care. With the funding in the reshoot of the governor's budget, all the improvements in the child care package for employment-related daycare that you heard about during the budget hearings would also apply to the jobs program and the people on the TANF side. So the child care rate increases, the change in the copayment that the client pays, as well as the change in the eligibility, would all be applied to this population, as well as just to the non-TANF ERDC population.
Madam Chair, Ms. Baker, is there a graduated scale for the copayment?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, yes, there is.
Sure, because I want to go back to something Senator Winters said that I think is real, real important. So as a person gets a job, do you just say bang and you
have no more child care, and they're expected to carry the load of this child care, where they've gotten this job that might be $2 or $4 over regulations, and then you cut them off, or do you then start applying the graduated scale?
Chair Carter, it's an excellent point. The goal here is to make that transition smoother.
Okay.
That's the goal of the post-TANF program. Now, I can't speak to... We're not totally adjusting the child care program in a way that would totally get rid of that cliff. However, what we are creating is a 12-month support program that if they start making too much, if a parent starts making too much and they become income ineligible, they'll still have some support, they'll still have medical, they'll still have the $150 a month. It's not perfect. And I would like just to say we're not creating the Cadillac here, but we're creating a really good redesign. But it doesn't get to every issue.
No question. I think it's important for Mr. Todd to answer, because these are some of the critical components that we faced in previous legislative session. And for me, I think the agency needs to be very clear as to whether or not when an individual, their earnings reach, they get a job, and suddenly they get a raise, because when they get the job, we're still paying daycare. But the first time they get a raise, or maybe two raises, then as an agency, we have said, well, you no longer qualify for daycare, even though the daycare still may be needed. And we did go through a process in this state where, I think it was Sandy Hoback, had designed a system to where we were able to continue the individual under care, and that occurred until budget crunch hit, and we cut those benefits. So is the agency coming up with a design to handle that particular issue?
Chair Carter, Senator Winter, members of the committee, I think that the separation of the two programs is really the issue, that during the budget constraints, the eligibility threshold for ERDC, the employment-related daycare program, was reduced from 185% to 150% of poverty. That's being addressed in the policy package currently that's in the governor's budget to raise that back to 185% and lower the copay amount. The issue still will remain that with the post-TANF program, its maximum eligibility, if you will, within that 12 months, maxes out at 250% of poverty. So there is potential that someone that reaches the 186th percentile or percent of poverty will lose their child care eligibility, but will remain eligible for the post-TANF program. The post-TANF program stipend is not going to be counted against their income when you're doing that calculation, though. So they will be purely looking at what is their actual income as opposed to the income plus the stipend. That stipend does have an impact on the food stamp grant, but it's a small impact. So we don't.
Thank you, Chair Carter, and thank you for the excellent questions. So what's another very important support is medical assistance. And so, and I won't go through all of this, but essentially, medical assistance is another stability item for someone who goes off to work and might not have coverage through their employer. And our goal here is to provide health coverage throughout the TANF participation, whether it's in pre-TANF, post-TANF, or regular TANF, as we're calling it. One of the things that we discovered in the course of putting together 2469 is that there is one eligibility criteria in transitional medical that says one of the eligibility requirements is that you have to have been on Medicaid for three of the previous 6 months. The challenge of that is, let's say somebody comes in the door to TANF, they apply, they're relatively job ready, they haven't been covered on Medicaid, they're in pre-TANF for a month, and then they bop into post-TANF. They get a job, we start providing some monthly stipend. They haven't met that three of the previous 6 month requirement to get transitional medical. And so one of the cost drivers that's on top of the co-chair's budget is to fix this gap in transitional medical. And we'll see the price tag for that. It's a little over $4 million. It's something that we missed in the original the drafting, and it's something that's incredibly important if we're going to help those families in their transition, in their stability, to keep them from coming back into the program.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, I think that this piece is as important as the issue that Senator Winters was raising around child care, that these are two critical elements that help with the stability issue.
Okay. And Chair Carter, in the set of amendments that you'll be seeing, I believe the Dash 20s, there will be an amendment to implement this fix for 1 year of the coming biennium as a recognition that doing it for the entire biennium was a little more expensive than we might have, but so you'll be seeing an amendment to that regard, and hope the committee can support that add-on. As I mentioned earlier, we're also going to be going back to what we used to do, which is provide a little bit of the child support collected on behalf of TANF families to actually go back to the families. Currently, what we do, the state collects the child support dollars from the non-custodial parents. The state's required to give some back to the federal government, and we keep all the money for child support enforcement. So none of that money goes back to the TANF families. The federal government has changed some of their way they do child support. So in this bill, starting October of 2008, when the change goes into effect, we would allow families to receive $50 for each child, up to $200, in child support that is collected on their behalf. Research is very clear in this regard. By allowing that child support pass-through, some level of support back to the families, it increases non-custodial parent participation, also increases child support collections. So really good change, costs a little under $1 million to implement for the next biennium, and you'll see that in the ad package. One of the other changes you'll see in terms of the budget estimate that the program did, that the department did initially, was how we ran our sanction policy. Currently, the department can cut part or all of a family's grant if they're not cooperating with the case plan. And unfortunately, there aren't really consistent processes, back to the uniform process, statewide uniformity in place to ensure families aren't inappropriately sanctioned. It was really important for those of us working on the bill to make sure the sanction policy was really in alignment with what we're trying to achieve in terms of our outcomes to help the children and the family succeed. The department had originally made an estimate, it's a matter of degrees on when they would start sanctioning a family, and so there's a different level of savings with regard to the sanction policy that you'll see in the budget estimate. But what's really important, 2469A, is that the department will still have the ability to cut part or all of the grant off if the family's not cooperating. However, there will be a clear set of guidelines of when that can happen, and can only happen after all the potential barriers have been addressed. It's very clear that if a family's, we heard in testimony in the subcommittee or in the policy committee that, what if an individual has a learning disability and it's not identified and they're having trouble participating in whatever is part of their plan? If we can identify the learning disability and help them have a plan that meets their abilities, then they're going to cooperate and they will stay on the grant. And that's what we're trying to do, looking at the individual needs. Sanction should be a last resort, especially a full family sanction, which is taking all the money away from the family. And we are in consensus on this. This was one of the more longer conversations we had on the bill. And I think we are in agreement of what the sanction policy looks like now. It is a little different from the initial proposal, so you'll see that in the estimate. One of the things we're including back in 2469 is allowing more post-secondary education as a work activity. This would go into effect October of next year. And this goes back to the Parents of Scholars initiative back in the 03 session that said we should allow 1% of the caseload to pursue 2 or 4 year degree as work activity, because the research again has shown post-secondary education is a key driver in long-term self-sufficiency and higher earnings. So we are adding that back in with a slight fix.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you. I want to make sure I'm staying with you and got this properly in my mind. You were under this program. You take away money from families that they have coming to them in order to keep them on the TANF program. I mean, that's a situation that can arise.
Chair Carter and Representative Carter, are you referring to the child support or the sanction policy?
Everything. In other words, you're not working on a gross number. You're working on all these individual net numbers that the money that's funneling into this family, regardless of where the school sources are. But depending on circumstances, you have the ability to cut off that funding or to take that funding in order to keep them on the TANF program. And do I have this right?
Mr. Todd, but it doesn't sound like it does. It doesn't sound like it, but Mr. Todd.
Chair Carter, Representative Gerard, I think the issue here is that this is really a partnership between the division or the department and the client. And there's a joint expectation established around a plan to move the family forward. And so really what we're doing is putting in place a stronger assessment and evaluation process to ensure that if, in fact, we get to a sanction place, that's used as a tool to get the client to reengage.
But his question, his question was, do you take away money in order for them to stay on TANF? If a parent is receiving child care from the dad or the mom, whomever is not out of the home, right, the non-custodial parent, and they get money, his question is, do child support people keep all of the money as a result of the person being in the program and receiving a stipend along with their money? And I'm saying that what I saw in 2469A, that you would have all at least $50 of that money being a pass-through to the client. And I think that's the question you was asking.
Once again, Madam Chair, you're far more articulate than I am. This good senator sitting next to you pointed out in a couple moments.
Chair Carter, Representative Gord, that's a really good question. Our current policy is, if you're on TANF and you have child support, you don't get any of it.
Right.
I'll make it pretty clear. Yeah. So what this is doing is, this is going back to what we used to do prior to 1996, before the feds changed their law, is to allow a little bit of that money to go through. So some of it goes to essentially supporting them on TANF, but the goal is to have some of that money go back to them because of the outcomes that are attached with that. You know, non-custodial parents are going to want to know if a little bit of that money is actually going back into the household, they're more likely to pay. Once a family is off the full TANF program and in the post-TANF, they keep 100% of their child support. Because they wouldn't technically be in the program.
Very nice of you.
Madam Chair? Senator Wardley,
but I want to make sure that the representative has finished his.
I am.
Okay.
Oh,
sorry.
Did you want me to do
if
again?
We could go back to that slide on the current program and what's projected under the new program.
This one?
No. No, you had it. The 100 clients who are...
Oh, one second there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Talk to us about the selection process, the criteria to be included in that 100 clients who currently participate, and then what selection criteria would be applied to the limited to 1% of the TANF caseload.
Chair Carter, Senator Gordley, right now the 100 is called the Degree Completion Initiative, and which allows 100 people to participate for up to a year in getting a 2 or 4 year degree. And people apply for that process, and they have to. It has to be in a vocation to get a degree that's going to lead them to sustainable employment, and so they apply through central office. We review those to make sure that they do have a plan in place with their funding and those kind of pieces, and it's at an approved school, and so it just to make sure that it, and then we also monitor their progress. We haven't worked through a lot of the details on what an implementation strategy would look like to implement the Parents of Scholars program, but I would assume it would be a similar process where we'd probably manage it centrally and with some criteria.
Not to cut you off, I'm sorry. Did you finish your thought? Okay. One of the concerns I would have would be if we're factoring for bias in how these programs are currently set up and how what's being proposed would be established. If there's an application process, then what is the process for people finding out about their opportunity and option? And I'm drawing on some of my past experience working with the state agency corrections years ago. But we had a work release program that allowed women to transition out of the prison back to the community. And there were two ways you could get out: work release or education release. The bias involved had the result of black women of color, more than likely coming out on work release. They had 30 days to find a job. If they didn't, they went back to the institution. More than likely, white women got into the education release program, and there wasn't the time constraint on the education program. So there was bias in selection and also bias in implementation. I carry that history in my head, which leads me to ask a question here about how people find out about the program and then actually have the opportunity. I mean, if you've got a caseworker who thinks you're ought to have the information, you get the information. But what if you've got a caseworker who has some kind of bias and you don't get the information? I mean, that's real life bias that happens in our...
And that's a very, very, very important question. I was one of the people who moved to Oregon, had 2.5 years of college, and started my life all over again. And the only way I could get into a school program after being in DHS for 1 year, I had to be seen by a psychiatrist, go through the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation, and everything else just to get a higher education program. So you need not think that this is not an important question. And I have to tell you, I will be watching you on this one. If you're going to put 100 people in a program, I'm going to want to know your clear and sustainable guidelines for being able to know who is in that program.
And the point is, as I understand it, there are 100 people in a program now. And so we would want to know what our current experience looks like and then be informed by that experience. But at the same time, just be mindful of, be conscious of the concern that I'm raising. That's what I'm asking. And I'd like to hear a response.
Yeah.
Chair Carter,
I was about to answer, but I kept cutting him off. My apologies.
Chair Carter, Senator Gordley, what I was going to suggest is that we submit to you what our current criteria is in practice, and then would appreciate any feedback in terms of how to improve that as we go to design this expanded piece.
Criteria, practice, and results, you know. Not just part of the picture, but what does it actually look like in terms of application?
We'll share that with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, sister, on that subject, can you add to the information there why it's limited to 1% of the TANF caseloads? Well, I mean, whether it's dollars, whether it's the population demographics, what is the rationale behind the 1%?
Chair Carter and Senators, excellent question. In 2003, when we put in the statute this 1% requirement, straight out, you need to get the bill passed that have the resources to do more. It is somewhat arbitrary, so it's approximately 180 individuals, more or less, 180 cases. That could be pursuing that. What we ended up doing in this bill is, in 03 when we passed that, there was a caveat that said we can't implement this until reauthorization of the federal program. Well, it took quite a few years. That's what happened in the Deficit Reduction Act. So in this bill, we're taking out the federal reauthorization piece, which allows us to implement it. You're asking really good questions. This is a really important part of the program. The degree completion initiative is kind of the it's kind of what we had hoped to achieve in 2003. The problem is now they're limiting it to 12 months. And what we hope to do is, if someone's trying to pursue a two-year degree, they need support for 24 months, not 12 months. And so that's the difference between what the current program is and what 2469 will do. But the 1% is an arbitrary number.
I just wanted to make certain that that, too, is not a biased issue, because they're in some quarters, we know that most of the families that we're talking about are women with children.
She got the question for you.
All right. Can we just take another 5 minutes? So,
and I'm going to, Jerrica, let me wrap up. Let's get to the money part. Last couple slides here. And I, big caveat here, and I will defer to Ms. Baker on this. TANF financing is super complicated. This is our best estimate of where we are now. This will continue to change a little bit. What you see in the base, I'm going to move to the next slide, actually. So everything, the co-chair's budget and the governor's budget had $20 million earmarked for this redesign. That was an estimate based on an initial set of what this was going to do, what we needed to do here in the state. With the reshoot, that number actually dropped to 19.1. In 2469, so for the 19.1 million, you're getting the enhancements we talked about, the post-TANF, increased screening assessment, some of the other things that we've been talking about. The additions in 2469A are the child support pass-through, the transitional medical fix at 4.25, and less savings now because we've adjusted the sanction policy, so that's the 1.47. So the total package for the redesign is $25.8 million, at least in our best guess at this point. I hope I'm getting this right. I cannot emphasize enough what a good investment this is. We've not touched this program in close to 10 years. People say, well, can we do it for cheaper? I don't think we can do it for cheaper. This is going to get us where we need to go in terms of meeting our federal requirements. The other thing we can think about is, well, why don't you just raise the income eligibility limit so people can stay in the program longer while they're working? You know, if they make a little more money, they can stay in the program, we can count them as working. Just to raise the income eligibility limit from 43% of the federal poverty line to 50% of the federal poverty line would cost us $42 million. This is as inexpensive of a redesign that we can get and still get the outcomes we need. So I will leave it at that. And just the last slide, you'll see that all the list of collaborators. Oh, excuse me. That would actually, $42 million would take us to 66% of the federal poverty line, which means a few more people could stay in the program, be working, and we could count them. And I just wanted to note that these two gentlemen have worked very hard on this redesign. We've had a variety of people. Representative Ron Maurer and his staff have worked hard. The Child Support Division, Joel Fisher, my LA, and a variety of advocates who you'll get to hear from some of. So this is really a group effort. This is a huge, huge program redesign and worth every penny that we can put into it. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very, very much. Good job. Thank you. I'd like to call Ms. Sabrina Lopez, League of Women Voters, Ian Finch, Center for Family Success, Julie Burnett, Center for Family Success. And because we want to hear everybody that is on the agenda, would you guys please come forward?
Oh,
yeah. No, right there. I just want you to hurry because we got about 2 minutes each so we can get everybody in.
Okay.
Thank you. Don't be nervous. This is a good group up here. They really, really like this program and want to help citizens of Oregon. So don't be nervous, okay?
Okay.
Be relaxed. Okay.
I'm Ian Finch, and I'm a former TANF recipient. I'm a single father, and I got five kids, ages 12, 11, 8, 7, and 2. And I went through, I got a job at the Center for Family Success through the Jobs Plus program. And when I actually took that job, I was featured in an article in the Oregonian on April 18th, front page, about my testimony on
the
bill before. And what I essentially did when I took a job was I lost money by taking a job. I lost my money. I made less money at my job than I did receiving my TANF and my food stamps. And so so I took the job anyways because being a single father with all these kids, I wanted to show my kids that the the better road isn't always the easiest road. And also, I was going to school at nights, too, on top of everything else. Because I knew if I get that secondary education, I will be able to get a better job. And even though it's a struggle now, in the future, I will be off welfare, off everything. And not only that, I have five kids. And so by me getting off TANF, going to school, I'm hopefully I'm breaking that cycle. My children's mother is incarcerated, so my kids are more likely to be incarcerated themselves. So what I need to do is I need to increase the protective factors for them. And by working, by going to school, I'm being a role model. I'm showing them that I can do this. So hopefully, as they become adults, they have this role model that I said, like I said, the better road is not always the easier road. So if you look at all my five kids not being on welfare, not being in the criminal justice system, you're saving a lot of money right there with just my family alone. And there's lots of families like mine out there that I didn't want to be on welfare. I was embarrassed to be on welfare. It was, you know, I couldn't afford things for my kids that they needed. I couldn't afford the, you know, the just the normal things that everyday kids have. So it wasn't like I wanted this free ride. I wanted to better myself, but I needed some time to get everything in order in my life so I can be in the position I am today where I am working. My kids aren't just hanging out. They're in good programs. But I had to do a lot of work myself. But the supports that this bill helps, I guarantee it would help my family, and it wouldn't even help me necessarily. It would help my children become the adults that I hope I can raise by myself without their mom or any family here in Oregon. So thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you for being here. I'm Julie Bennett, and I am a Jobs Plus worker at the Center for Family Success. I just would like to say that, first off, I've been on and off the program, TANF program, for years, and I was fighting a losing battle because I had an addiction. And I was able to get away with that for a long time because nobody assessed me correctly. And I didn't want to tell anybody that because of what I knew. And so now I am... In 29 days, I'll have 2 years, and finally now will I be able to make any progress. What I know of the bill so far today, the hope that it will give people is necessary. I've had to fight very hard to get where I'm at today. I'm now reestablishing my credit, which is so important. If without credit or without having good credit or no credit. And the only reason I'm able to do that is because of the statute of limits that ran out on some of my bills. And nobody helped me, you know, as far as credit counseling, which is a very important part of why I'm where I'm at. I have a student loan that I've done a rehabilitation on, so soon I will be able to put myself back into school. I didn't know about the program, so I'm glad you asked that question, the program where going to college is an option, and being able to, had I known about that, that would have helped, and so I'm hoping that you guys stand on that. But I have three kids, a 15-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 6-year-old. And without the support that I have for my family, right now I wouldn't be able to do it. I took a pay cut being on to the Jobs Plus program too. There's a long story around that, but child care is kind of killing me. I'm a hard worker, and I'm very determined, and I know that I'm going to work out. I'm one of the lucky ones to have that inside of me. So the child support and then having my children in activities, helping them build their confidence, because confidence for me building my confidence was most important. And so knowing that I had hope in the future was helpful, knowing that I had an opportunity someday soon to go to school, knowing that I could do it, having, you know, not knowing that you, not thinking that you can do it, not having an education, not having support,
not having anything but yourself and your life experiences that you've led up to where you're at, not knowing what you're going to do and knowing you can't do anything with what you have already is very damaging to your self-esteem. And so just having the support that this bill shows that it will give is a huge thing. Just it'll build the self-esteem and the courage for people to want to even go further. So, and it also is very good for the children to see their parents being able to further their education, and for them, it'll break generational curses is what I call it. It'll build generational blessings in my eyes. So it's really helpful.
Congratulations. We appreciate you being here today. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
okay.
They got votes. We got 15 more. Is this all? Are they participants in Center for Success?
Yes.
And we, I think most of us on this panel do recognize that the model Center for Success is highly successful. In fact, I have a Senate Bill 845 on the Senate side to try to expand Center for Success across the state. So.
Thank you very much. I love your expression, Senator Westman and I were speaking to each other, generational blessings.
Yes.
I like that. I also want to just make sure I didn't confuse you in comments I made earlier about the educational program that was available. I was speaking of a program that was available years ago. But I do want to ask you if you are aware of or if you've been a participant in the Jobs Plus education benefit. It's a small benefit.
I've never heard of it before.
I'm currently receiving that scholarship right now.
You are?
Yes.
But you've not heard of it before. I hope someone's listening to that.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Because there's a substantial pool of money that's sitting there.
Thank you. Action Carter,
members of the committee. My name is Brina Lopez, and I'm here representing the League of Women Voters. And I'll just be brief. There's nothing that I could probably say that would be as powerful as what these folks have said. But the League of Women Voters is an organization that has a long history through our social policy positions of advocating for families in poverty, especially through programs which promote self-sufficiency. And we really believe that many of the changes that House Bill 2469A contemplate really move our state forward in terms of helping families with self-sufficiency. We especially are excited about the new opportunities for education and job training and the post-TANF programs that will help folks with those extra supports, especially in child care, for a little bit longer. So thank you for this opportunity. We commend Representative Kotek especially for all the hard work that she's done in working this out. So thank you for this chance to testify and submit testimony.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Good luck to the two of you.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up and then you can talk, Senator, while they're coming up. Emily Katz, Kara Oregon, Sarah Melton. What is it? Melton, M-E-R, okay. Patty Whitney Wise, Senator.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I just don't want to leave this Jobs Plus point quite yet. I really want to unpack and understand how one client can know about the program and the other program and the other client did not get the information about the program. For years, we've been hearing that we have this pool of money that's unused in the Jobs Plus program. And this illustration goes to that point. I need to understand how it is that that happens. And so if someone could unpack that.
Mr. Todd, at an appropriate time, I'd like for you to speak with us about that. Is that your area?
Chair Carter, I was not listening.
It's a Jobs Plus, a Jobs is your area, or is it a TANF manager area? Who is in charge of that at the department?
That's under me.
Very good. So we want you to, later on, we want you to speak to that.
Okay.
Thank you. To the panel.
Okay. I'll get us started.
2 minutes.
My name is Emily Katz. I'm here with CARE Oregon. CARE Oregon is a Medicaid-managed care organization and a Medicare special needs plan. We have about 95,000 members on the Oregon Health Plan, and about a third of our members rely on TANF medical benefits. In March, I came before the DHS and Women's Wellness Committee to report on Care Oregon's loss of more than 85,000 TANF members over the past year. And since I even came to that committee, we have continued to lose over 700 more members off of the TANF program. And I'm sorry, I'm saying TANF, and it's Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. I'm just trying to be brief. So a single parent looks very different today than 10 years ago, even. Pay is not keeping up with inflation, and medical inflation is far outpacing both. So TANF is no longer a typical welfare program. Today, a single event could see any one of us or our families needing temporary assistance. So TANF serves a very deep need in our communities that we all live in. And nowhere is this more acute to me than in medical services. So this is important to consider when looking at the TANF program redesign, like we've seen with the erosion of the OHP standard benefit. When people lose medical benefits, all of us feel the downstream effects in the form of increased cost shift and worse medical outcomes. So with the TANF, and I have extended medical, and I mean to say transitional medical, so please excuse me. With the TANF transitional medical benefit, we're giving clients a leg up to succeed in school, in the workplace, and enhance their overall quality of life. We're not punishing needy families who may have gotten a job quickly and that may not even provide them health insurance by just terminating their Oregon health plan coverage. Losing coverage means a lack of continuity of care, losing a primary care provider, disruption in wellness care for children, vaccines, and other vital prevention services. So that results in fragmented, more expensive care, which is what I think we are trying to avoid. So Care Oregon's pleased that 2469A has included the transitional medical benefits as part of the robust redesign of the overall program. And while the DRA has brought many challenges to our state, it's also brought this opportunity for a great redesign to work better for the clients who need these services. So that's all I have to say, and I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you. Next panelist.
Chair Carter, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Merton, and I am a public policy consultant, and I'm working currently with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I've been working on the TANF program for over a decade, so I've seen a lot of changes over the years. And I think that the bill that you have in front of you today really represents a positive step in the right direction for Oregon and for the families that are served by the TANF program. I've also been involved with a coalition of nonprofit organizations working on this bill. And you have in front of you a letter from that coalition and it's attached to a two-page fact sheet that really talks about some of the highlights of the bill, and I'm not going to go into that since you have that in front of you. But I did just really want to emphasize the importance of the transitional medical assistance piece. This is really an issue of fairness and of equity. When we designed the post-TANF program, we didn't really take into account the fact that there may be some people that would transition really rapidly into that program. And seeing as though that the emphasis of the jobs program and of TANF is to encourage people to obtain employment, it seems unfair to penalize people that are able to obtain that employment rapidly. People that are in the pre-TANF program, and if they have not been on Medicaid for 3 of the previous 6 months, they would be ineligible for transitional medical assistance. The bill enables the department to make some eligibility changes to Medicaid that would fix that problem. So I think that's a really important piece to mention. And the other thing that I handed out were the Dash 2 amendments, and Representative Kotek mentioned them. They come with a hefty price tag, but I really cannot emphasize enough the need to look at the countable income limit in the TANF program. This is the income eligibility limit for which people are allowed to come onto the program and the point at which they're kicked off of the program. This limit has been frozen since 1991. There are only 2 states in the nation that have lower income eligibility limits than Oregon. The Dash 2 amendments would tie the income eligibility limit for this program to 66% of the federal poverty line. And this is where the income eligibility limit was before it was frozen in 1991. This is critical because if you look across the array of every other support program for low-income families, they're all tied to the some sort of income limit. So I think it's really important to look at this and to stop the erosion of purchasing power that the TANF grants had over the years. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Patty Whitney Weiss with the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and you have my testimony before you. I just want to point out a couple of things. What Senator Winters was talking about in terms of a program that was successful, we are partially restoring in House Bill 2469, but we're not the piece that Sarah just mentioned, that piece of at what point are they eligible to come on, is not being addressed because of the price tag, that $42 million. In order to be successful again, we're going to have to at least go up that high. Think about it. If you have to be at 43% of poverty, you have to be very poor, on the verge of homelessness, in order to meet that criteria, which means it's going to take that much more time and services to get you back up to where you can be self-sufficient again. If we're at the 66% level, we haven't dropped quite so far, we would be able to meet our work participation rates that much easier. These folks aren't as poor, don't have as many problems, haven't fallen into such destitution. So we're really hurting ourselves by continuing to allow that erosion. And I know it's a big money item. On the other hand, I think ultimately that's the only way we're going to get to our work participation rates and keep them and really help these families before they get so desperately poor. So I have to bring that before you as a very strong recommendation from the task force that we did have a successful program, a very successful program. We were a national model. We're moving in that direction. People are being commended for the work they've done. If we can't do it this year, I urge you to at least get an ongoing committee that works on this over multiple years. It probably will take us several sessions to get all the way back up to where we were realistically. But let's not lose sight of that and just do one thing this year. Let's keep moving in that right direction so we really help these families. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Mullen, Ms. Kelly, and Ms. Lowe. Members, I'd like to ask you to give us a few minutes extra so that we can hear our last panel. Representative Gore?
Madam Chair, I just take a quick opportunity here to join my Senate colleagues in their concern about the Jobs Plus program. There is a bill out there, 2246, introduced by Senator Gordley, that now may be a very appropriate time to renew our interest in that bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I hate to cut you off, but we have 2 minutes each.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I won't read my testimony, but just will point out a couple of things. In fact, I'll deviate a bit from the remarks that I intended to make, just to say that I'm very pleased to see the institutional memory that's here about the programs. I worked on these programs back in the 1980s. We had something called Move Jobs that Senator Winters was talking about. The change that happened at the federal level with welfare reform changed the program for the entire country. There were some positive aspects of that, but some negative aspects of it as well. And now with the changes at the federal level, we really have no choice in Oregon but really to take a look at redesigning the program because we have directives from the federal government. But I really want to acknowledge the work of all of the people that worked on this bill, but I especially want to single out Representative Kotek for her tremendous work on all of this. And I think we have collectively, through the work that we've done, delivered the best bill that I think is possible under the circumstances, given the requirements and the fiscal restraints that we face. Now, having said that, my testimony also speaks to a number of things that I would like to have seen us be able to do, but I recognize that I think this bill is about the best that we can get in the state of Oregon, and I remain committed to working not only in this session but beyond to make sure that we not only have the best bill but we have the best program possible and we move on to the future to make other design changes that are necessary for future recipients. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Marsha Kelly, and I'm with the American Association of University Women of Oregon. We have 2,000 members in the state of Oregon from Lake Future, Lake Oswego, from Astoria to Wallowa County. Our goal is education, and our theme in our 125th anniversary year is education as the gateway to economic security. And so we have been very involved in the Parents of Scholars program. I personally served on the Degree Completion Initiative Stakeholders Group, and look forward to the implementation of the Parents as Scholars. We think that that educational piece of this program is very, very important. Children's well-being can only be enhanced by the educational level that their parents attain, and that program could really help. Do not think that the program would be paying for the tuition. The tuition that somebody would have to pay, they would have to get on their own. We're hoping on a national level that there are some bills in Congress moving forward which will allow part-time students more flexibility, and we're hoping on the association level that that will continue to go forward. But as far as this program goes, we're very pleased that it's including an ability to spend more than 12 months in a degree completion program. And we're pleased that there is an opportunity maybe for our members and other people to help mentor students by even just helping them with daycare while they're studying for final exam. So I expect that the department who has been in contact with me will continue with that mentoring program. And I again would like to thank Representative Kotek for her work on this, as well as the work of the policy committee, because I think there were other people on that policy committee who really brought some strengths to the building that you have before you.
Thank you.
Chair Carter and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, legislative advocate for the Oregon Food Bank. It's 20 regional food bank network and over 800 helping agencies throughout the state. I come to this with a long history. I look at Senator Winters, and one of the people I remember is now in Congress, who I always associated with the new jobs program, and that was Darlene Hooley, who chaired the subcommittee on Ways and Means, where we put together the new jobs program. I think what we were looking for then is what maybe is our opportunity now, and that's to provide some stability for those who are coming to us for assistance. And so we call it TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Too often it isn't temporary, and it hasn't been because we haven't been there when people come to us for help with adequate pre-assessment, and we aren't there as they're going out into the workforce to make sure there are some supports for their family stability. The health care one is essential for them as they're moving out into that new job, because how many of you have ever had a position other than perhaps an elected one where you were eligible for health care from the first day? You usually wait 6 months. And so this is a part of the program that we really do believe might give some stability, rather than just having it a temporary kind of spot in one's life where they keep coming back and we often think of them failing. Perhaps it's because we weren't there at the beginning to know what they needed, and we weren't there when they left to provide that continuing foundation. I too wish to acknowledge Representative Cota, who began working on this when she actually was a legislative advocate at the Oregon Food Bank a number of years ago, but also that Dr. Bruce Goldberg acknowledged and recognized that this was an opportunity. We had to do something because the Deficit Reduction Act required it. But he brought in all kinds of stakeholders to participate in redrafting and redoing the program. In many ways, I look at this and the proposal is doing it on the cheap. Even with Amendment 2, it's still not bringing us back to where we were when then-Representative Hooley had us embarked on the new jobs program. And so I think this is an investment that will pay off, and I encourage you to support 2469 along with Amendment 2. There are dollars. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Further discussion? Thank you very much, members, for giving us some overtime. And
thank you, colleagues. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you very much, Representative Kirchhoff. So we'll see you on
at this point, members of the subcommittee, we don't have any hearing scheduled for next week. We expect that will change. So we'll keep you posted.
Thank you very much, committee.